Calling the House Committee on Healthcare to order, and we will stand at ease for a bit. I want to try and at least keep my promise. Let's come back to order, excuse me, and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 327A.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Monis Anderson, and I'm a senator from Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And there are two bills I would like to talk about, but let's start. Which one did you open up on?
I opened up 327.
Okay, so
we have your boss here, just showed up in the back room. You want to? He'll wait.
Okay. as you know, scope of practice has been such a problem. It's vexed us all every time a scope comes before us. So to address this, during the interim, a broad-based group of stakeholders was convened under the Portland Consensus Program. And we had Sam Imperati as a facilitator, and we had just about every stakeholder of healthcare there that dealt with scope of practice. And Senate Bill 327 is actually a result, actually is an example of the right way to consider healthcare scope of practice issues. The naturopaths came to me, the naturopathic physicians came to me, offered themselves as guinea pigs for the first scope of practice review, and they really did work hard, and I'm sure that you will be receiving a booklet, I think, of what they went through in describing why their scope should be changed. We had the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, the Oregon Nurses Association. We had every group you can think of, and we worked on areas of agreement and disagreement. In fact, there was a scoring system on every aspect of the guideline process that they liked or they didn't like, and I'm sure that if you want that summary, I certainly can get it to you. But I felt that the naturopathic physicians made a very clear and compelling case for modernizing their prescriptive prescribing authority. So that is sort of, do you want any more information regarding the process at all?
And the other group that worked on it also were the psychologists, I think.
And I know that bill is in my committee, and so I hear that went through this side.
Yeah, it did, and it was sort of a one-sided response. So, I mean, we had hoped that you have all advocates. I think that worked a little less well on that.
And I think that is a problem that we need to address. That was one of the intents of a scope of practice bill that I had introduced last time in trying to get so that we would have both sides of the picture. So during the interim, I plan to look at what we did this time and look at a better method that will do a summary of what we accomplished this session and then hopefully come forward with recommendations next time around, because it really needs to be two-sided, and if the other side doesn't want to come to the table, then that means they don't have a case, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and we'll be happy to work as
okay.
The last 7 years. Okay.
But regarding I want just to say a little bit about 327. Basically, the examples from the physicians were very compelling to me as an individual and as a nurse in why this bill should pass. One was a physician from Kaiser who is a general internist practicing hospitalist medicine, and he was co-managing patients with a naturopathic physician. And he really found that naturopaths are trained and educated as primary care physicians, that is their scope, and they do have the same knowledge base to draw upon for prescribing pharmaceutical drugs as does any MD. And then another MD stated that he had a number of patients who see him as well as a naturopath, and he found it a waste of patients' time for a patient to have two visits. Because as you know, a naturopath can prescribe just about every medicine that you can think of if they're naturally derived. And I'm sure if you look in that booklet, you'll see all of the medications, all penicillins, lithium, antidepressants, etc., as long as they're naturally derived. Yet what they found, if we have a blood pressure, a diuretic is the most effective, actually, blood pressure medicine to start out with. They cannot prescribe that. They have to prescribe, if they do, which they don't, a more expensive one with more side effects. So they would have to refer their patient to someone else blood pressure med. So I think that's all I wanted to say, because I know you're going to have a lot of great testimony on 327, but I do want you to know I was very pleased with the process that they went through and the guidelines that they followed. We did need to have the opposition come forward. We did have two meetings, but it really should have been done before they even came to the committee. But I think you, it seemed, had the same problems when you were working on the psychologist bill.
We did. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 327. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 605.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, again, I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, and I am here in advocating that you look favorably on Senate Bill 605. As you know, Oregon is a leader, extreme leader in the nation on nurse practitioner and clinical nurse specialist issues. In 1979, we granted nurse practitioners dispensing authority, but current administrative rules say that they must personally dispense drugs to the patient. And this was due in part to the Board of Nursing Council's opinion that since the law did not specifically address delegation, it could not be assumed. So what we wanted to do is actually say that non-judgmental dispensing functions may be delegated to staff assistants. It's really, these are medications, they're already labeled, they're already ready to go to be given to the patient, and for a nurse practitioner to have to come out of the room to actually personally give the medications to the patient is really inefficient and a waste of time. This bill just adds language to the Nurse Practice Act, which will make it exactly the same as the Medical Practice Act, because the physicians are able to have someone make dispense medications in a non-judgmental situation. But again, I know you'll have a more expertise, probably nurse practitioners coming to testify on that issue. And with that, I'd like to conclude my testimony.
Senator Moniz, can I ask you a question? I've had informal discussions over this one, and I'm still unclear on what the definition of a non-judgmental function is. Did you have a chance to explore that?
Well, they are not making the decision of what type of medication or how much medication. All they have to do is hand the medication. It's already packaged. So a non-judgmental is one where they are not making any judgments on the type or the amount, and I'm sure the people in the back can explore that more with you.
They'll know what I'm... I mean, what I'm asking is, you have a drug cabinet and it has a bunch of prepackaged things, and you have X and Y and Z and A and B and C and...
Samples.
Or even pre-labeled prepackaged products. And then is it a non-judgmental function to go in there and get the nystatin, whatever it is, and pick it out of that?
It has to have the patient's name on it. It's my understanding.
The patient's name on it. Okay. Mm-hmm. No, that I understand. Okay. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
be hearing a lot of testimony on this one.
You bet. Take care.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 605 and open a public hearing. Senator Courtney, is that 9 that you're interested in? Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 9 and ask President Courtney to enlighten us.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and Vice Chair Maurer, and members of the House Healthcare Committee. I'm here today along with Sasha Pollack, who's one of my key policy people who's worked very hard on House Bill, Senate Bill 9. My name is Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive, north here in Salem. 97303. I'm a state senator, District 11, which includes portions of Salem, all of Jervis and Woodburn. And I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 9, otherwise known as the PKU Bill. Way back in 1997, before any of you were born, I introduced House Bill 2388, which required insurance companies to cover treatment for PKU. In your testimony, you have the big word that represents, I cannot pronounce it, so it is known as PKU. In other inherited metabolic diseases, this bill passed both chambers unanimously and then was renewed in 2001, because in order to get it passed, and when I get through my official testimony, to the extent you're interested, I'll tell you about the saga of 1997, but in order to get it passed back then, there had to be a sunset on it. And so we came back again in 2003, and we put another sunset on it. And so the bill that was passed way back in 1997 has always had a sunset. What this bill about today is the same piece of legislation that passed way back 12 years ago. But this is to say, once and for all, we're going to do this, remove the sunset permanently. And the Senate unanimously said yes to that a few weeks ago. We're here today to permanently remove this sunset, as I say in my second paragraph. This is an inherited disease which prevents an individual's body from processing phenylalanine. The excess accumulates in the blood and begins to damage the brain at a very, very young age. Without treatment or prevention, the brain damage is severe and it's irreversible. Treatment of PKU is so successful that all newborns are, by law, screened for it. And in fact, this state, the state of Oregon, was the very first state in the union to require screening of all newborns for PKU. We were the first state. The use of medical foods that this bill mandates coverage of is the only treatment for PKU. The use of medical foods can prevent mental retardation, gross motor dysfunction, strokes, tremors, seizure, coma, and death. These complications can develop without the use of medical foods and incur high costs to the insurance industry in the state. I urge you to eliminate the sunset in this state once and for all. I'm joined by some of the medical workers and families who had direct interaction with children affected by the inherited disease. And I thank you for listening to this testimony. When this bill first was introduced by me way back in 1997, I introduced it for a constituent, Caitlin Kelch. Her mother came to me and her father, they live in Kaiser. I then represented Kaiser. I was a state representative. I was a Democratic leader in the House. And Caitlin, their very young daughter, had PKU. And I remember at the time when we introduced it, I thought there wasn't a prayer of getting this bill through. And we did get it out of the House, and when it came to the Senate, I was told, Peter, we're going to give you a public hearing, which is not going to happen. So I testified that day, I think it was in hearing room either B or C, and I went back to the House floor, because we were on the floor at that time, and I got a note slipped to me 2 hours later that they had passed the bill out of committee unanimously. And in fact, in the three times the legislature has dealt with this issue, only one legislator has ever voted against this. So today, what we're about here is to say once and for all, Let's remove this sunset. You are going to probably hear some remarkable stories of what this food means to these children. I believe Caitlin is here today. She was a very young little girl that day she testified back in 1997. She's now no longer a young little girl. She's still very young, trust me. Very young and very successful. But it's almost emotional for me to talk about this because I'm often amazed when I hear legislators say, when I didn't get my bill through, I'm going to go to the ballot. I've been working on this for 12 years. 12 years, not complaining, but for 12 years, when I was in the minority and when I was in the majority, when I was in the House and I was in the Senate, I've been working on PKU. And I did not even carry it. I did not even carry it in the Senate. The good Jeff Cruz, remember, the opposite party, wanted to carry this bill. And so I said, go ahead. So this is not Democrat, Republican. This is not insurance mandate. You can call it that. It's well beyond all that discussion. This is children who have this inherited affliction, simple treatment, live normal lives. It's in their best interest. It's in our best interest. It's in everybody's best interest, cost-wise and just human nature-wise. So I thank you very much, Chair Greenlee, for even willing to hear the bill and allowing me to come here to testify today. And now I'll stand for any questions, comments, or criticisms that you may have of me, either about this or anything else.
It's open mic, huh?
Yeah, that's right. I got Sasha. As long as I got Sasha with me, I'm out.
Are there any questions? Senator, I have one. I've heard that there's an amendment, a proposed amendment to this bill about elemental foods, which came somewhere else.
Right.
Have you had any... or anything about it? It's not in front of us.
Can I have Sasha Pollock identify herself?
Sure, as a part of
this.
I don't want to make a mistake.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollock. I work in Senator Courtney's office. We are aware of the amendment. Senator Courtney has expressed to me in the past that he's neutral on it. It is another renewal of another coverage of a different type of it's a different type of disorder, and I know there are folks in the room who can speak more clearly to the differences between the elemental foods and the metabolic foods, but we are neutral on that amendment. Senator Courtney's focus has been in the past on PKU, and he's very eager to get that through. So with that being said.
So if it doesn't slow it down, it's not a problem in the... I'm assuming you say... I don't have an opinion on the amendment. I've just heard about it, and I talked to the Blue Cross representative, the regents who are going to be looking at it as well. They think it's probably covered already in their plan, too. Sir, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair? I'm sorry. Sasha, what if the sunset
are you,
is...
Are you going to testify? No, okay.
Thank you. If the sunset were allowed to, the bill wasn't to pass and it sunsetted out, what are the insurance companies, what would they do? They have not testified or not listed there. Have you had any conversation with them?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Maurer, we have not had any conversation with them. This is something they've covered for the last 12 years. It would be relatively surprising to me that they would stop covering it since they have a population that needs it. However, you know, things change in the insurance company, and I think that having this in statute as a required coverage is very, very important to the small population that this serves.
And it's going to become a perennial question. Oh, sorry.
Well, wait a minute, Chair Greenlee. Which sunset are you talking about? PKU sunset?
Correct.
Your question was what?
What would the insurance companies do? Would they say, well, it's not a mandate, we don't have to cover anymore? Would they stop covering it?
Wait a minute. The mandate's the mandate. The mandate exists in law now. The sunset, if we don't renew it, the mandate goes away. That's my understanding of the way the law is written. I'm not trying to make noise as a smart aleck, but that's my understanding of what we're dealing with here. So we've always been renewing that sunset to make sure the law stands. Now we're saying, let's not keep coming back to this, remove the sunset so the mandate remains permanently if this committee is willing to do that. Is that the question you asked?
That wasn't the question. The question was, what would the insurance company say, goodness, we're free of a mandate, we don't have to offer it, and thus leaving people in the lurch?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, I can respond to that. Actually, the reason that the amendment was implemented about the elemental foods was because it sunset. Nobody really paid any attention to it, and then the insurance company stopped covering it, and somebody found out then when they got a letter from their insurance company saying we no longer cover this, that had happened, and then brought it to the attention of their representative. So that is a very likely possibility.
Okay. Thank you. And then the follow-up question is because PEB at this point is going self-insured, they are not going to be under state insurance mandates. Do we have any clue whether or not, and I don't expect you to know the answer to this, but whether or not PEB would cover this under their plan?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Maurer, I don't have an answer to that, but you are correct that self-insured plans are not required, as our federal plans are not required to abide by any state law.
Okay.
Does our Medicaid program cover?
Chair Greenlick, I believe it does. It's not a requirement because of the state law, but there are other folks here who can answer that better than I.
Thank you, Senator.
And Senator, I'm not opposing the bill.
For future
he doesn't want to be number two.
Well, we have this. We have Senate Bill 9 open. What? Let's see the witness list.
That's for 9.
I'm sorry. What?
That's for 9.
Good. Thank you. Katie King, Nell Buist, and Kathleen Huntington. Can we start with that? Let's see. Do we have anybody from 100 miles away? Looks like we do, so we'll get them on next. Oh, Neil. Not Nell. Hi. Hello. How you doing, Neil? Shouldn't have had any trouble with it. Who's first?
I'm going to go first. For the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm the Government Relations Manager for the Public Health Division of DHS. And I'm representing Dr. Mike Skeels today, and so you can pretend this is my lab coat. But we are here in strong support of Senate Bill 9 and removing the expiration on this. And we also want to thank Senator Courtney and Sasha Pollack and our good friends at OHSU for their long leadership on this issue. And Senator Courtney had mentioned that in 1961 that Oregon became the first state to implement statewide PKU screening. And before that, up to 1% of the admissions at Fairview were untreated PKU patients. And since then, there has never been another such admission because of untreated PKU. So that's something that we're really proud of. We've been working with our friends at OHSU for 46 years to do early detection, medical consultation, follow-up, and clinical intervention. And we just really treasure this partnership. Since the program began, we've screened 1.7 million Oregon infants, and we've detected 650 infants with newborn metabolic disorders, and we've worked very closely with OHSU on the follow-up for those. Today, we screen for over 40 newborn metabolic disorders. And treatment is vital, and Dr. Skeels asked me to convey that there's little use in having a program to detect newborn metabolic disorders if we're not going to assure the treatment and follow-up. So I will leave the rest to my colleagues from OHSU, but we strongly urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman and members of the House Health Care Committee. My name is Dr. Neil Buist. I represent OHSU. I'm an emeritus professor up there and have been for many years. I ran the metabolic program, so I've seen this since the inception of things that we've been hearing about. I cannot better Senator Courtney's eloquence, for he has said for us really what we need to, I wanted to tell you. But PKU, this PKU disorder, is one of only several hundred different biochemical, genetic, hereditary glitches that can go wrong in your body. And depending upon which glitch it is, will depend what kind of problems the patient will suffer. In PKU, it happens to be brain damage. In some of the other disorders, it's heart damage, or muscle damage, or liver damage, so that they are not all the same. But the exciting thing about them is that in addition to PKU, most, if not all, of the disorders we screen for and a handful of others can be treated, ameliorated, and the disorders prevented by using medical foods. You have heard the term, and it will be explained better in just a minute. But medical foods are, in fact, absolutely the lifeline for these families. It must be understood that most regular foods are not an option for these families. They can't go out and have a bread and butter sandwich or a hamburger. Toxic. This means Thanksgiving, Christmas, wedding days, and so on. You're limited to the medical foods that you can have available that are safe for your body. So a diet that uses these kinds of foods, in fact, can give these patients some degree of normality. I want you to imagine for a second that you're a patient that's come to me, and you just had a newborn baby, and I'm your doctor. I have some good news for you and some bad news for you. The newborn blood screening test that we did last week on your baby shows that he's got a very rare and serious metabolic disease. We are lucky to detect it so earlier, before it causes brain damage, and treatment is available with special foods. However, we're not going to pay for it because we don't cover foods. They're not a covered benefit. I'm afraid you'll have to find the $5,000 to $12,000 every year for special foods that will prevent the brain damage. Now, if that counseling is happening around the country. And as far as use of medical foods, there is no really sign, cloud on the horizon that portends an early end to the medical necessity of these medical foods. And I therefore submit that there's no reason to continue the sunset clause on this bill. So we strongly support removing the sunset clause.
Neil, I'd like to follow my vice chair's question. Ms. King testified that since the screening started in 1961, there hasn't been a single admission to Fairview or equivalent institutions in the state. The insurance mandate started 12 years ago and covers 40% of the population, roughly. What happens to, how come we haven't reduced it by 40%? I mean, something's been going on.
Chairman Greenlick, the answer to that is that for the first 30 years or so of this program, the state covered all the medical, nutritional evaluation and management for these disorders. When fees were introduced into the business, it became somewhat more complicated, and for the first time, Oregon began to require and need insurance coverage for them, and since then it has been a daily battle.
That was under the Crippled Children's Division model of
Crippled
CDRC.
Crippled Children's Disease had to use federal money, state money to do this.
I'm sorry. I do. Okay. Now I'm confused. Currently, only...
You sounded confused before, too.
Did I?
No, yeah.
Okay. I'm just as confused now.
Thanks for clarifying.
Okay, clarify that further.
It's only required to be covered by insurances that are regulated in Oregon. So the exclusions are Medicare, not issue, Medicaid. But Medicaid is covered under Medicaid. Okay, so that's a big chunk. But all of the self-insureds aren't.
And 600,000 uninsured.
Okay, and 600,000 uninsured. So I'm particularly interested in the self-insurance. Portland Public School Trust, the Labor Union Trust, very large self-insured companies. Do we know where there are self-insureds out there not covering this thing?
Yes, they're not covered. It's an unfortunate situation. There are, I should introduce myself, I'm sorry. I'm Kathleen Huntington. I'm the dietitian in the metabolic clinic at CDRC, and I've worked with Dr. Buist, and I continue to work there. I've been there for 22 years. And we service all the individuals with inborn errors in metabolism in the state of Oregon at CDRC at the metabolic clinic at OHSU. So your question about whether individuals who have ERISA are impacted by ERISA, it is true that our medical foods law does not impact on them. And it's been our experience, because these have been rare diseases, that not very many patients have that type of insurance coverage in our state. And the ones that do, however, we have to, it's difficult. We finagle, and NORD, National Organization for Rare Diseases, does assist families whose children have PKU. They have set up an assistance program for families who have self-insured coverage.
How many new cases a year? I was figuring 4/10 per thousand, roughly. How many new cases a year do we have?
Of PKU?
First, yeah.
It varies, but it's about 4 to 5 a year, generally, in our state.
And about 10 of the other non-PKU disorders that are picked up by newborn screening.
Thank you.
Not 4 times some number, just 4.
Right.
4 or 5.
Are you? We didn't give you a chance to testify, right?
Well, not officially. Again, my name is, thank you, Chairman Greenlick, and representatives of the Health Committee. Again, my name is Kathleen Huntington, and I'm a dietitian in the clinic, and I work up at CDRC OHSU. And I wanted to speak to the reason why we had to get medical foods mandate is because these medical foods are very expensive. And if my handout here shows you an example of the cost. In the case for the types of disorders that have to follow a protein-restricted diet, the protein content of regular foodstuffs is 10 to 40 times the protein content of special medical foods that deal with low-pro issues. Yet the costs, wholesale costs versus retail costs of regular foods, is anywhere between 3 to 8 times the cost of regular foods. So there's a real advantage in using them for therapy, but the cost is prohibitive. And the fact that we've had a medical foods bill in the last 12 years here in Oregon has made the access equitable for all different socioeconomic groups, because inborn errors of metabolism just don't hit the poor people or the rich people. It hits everybody. And families cannot afford these things because they also pay for labs and clinical visits and the rest of the type of medical care that their children require. There are 37 other states, including that have passed laws in mandating coverage of medical foods. But Oregon, interestingly enough, has one of the best laws in the country. It's because they cover all disorders, inborn errors in metabolism, all ages, no caps, and all types of medical food. As a result, our children have better access in the state. And I wanted to add something about the amendment that Chairman Greenlick had inquired about. We were aware that Representative Edwards was interested in attaching an amendment. We are neutral about this in terms of being yay or nay, but it does address a totally different disease state. It deals with malabsorption as opposed to metabolism, and there are two different kinds of animals.
Could you help us just a little bit with what that other animal looks like?
There are a group of disorders. The disease one might have heard of is celiac disease, for example, where people cannot eat flour. That's one kind of malabsorption that you may have heard of. But there is a whole lot of other ones which have to be treated with more and more basic products until they become just made of simple chemicals, which means that they are elemental products. That is the term, that's what that term means. Similar to some of the products that are used in the management of PKU and metabolic diseases. There is a difference, however, I think, in the sense that the management of malabsorption, which is the intestinal problems, is handled in different ways by different people, and affects children in totally different manners. The products are not used in quite the same life-saving scenarios as they are for our metabolic diseases. Some of the products may be intellectually somewhat similar, but they are in fact not the same by any.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. Nice to see you again, Dr. Hughes.
And you too.
We have Evan and Andrea Owen, who've apparently come from more than 100 miles away, or at least check that box. And the sometimes it's hard to figure out what it is you're checking right now in the box. Please join us at any rate. Please introduce yourself.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thanks for giving me this opportunity to testify. My name is Evan Cruz. I am from Sutherland, Oregon, and my wife and son Owen would be joining us, except he's the noisy kid that's still,
noisy kids
we
up
can
here.
Still hear him. Well, he's 18 months old, and he does have PKU. Do you need my address?
That's fine.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm obviously supporting this measure. It's something that's extremely important to me. And in the written testimony I gave you, actually left out one detail that came up with the previous conversations, and I'll get to that. But I absolutely support the removal of the sunset clause. Our brief history of PKU: in 2007, Owen was diagnosed with PKU and very quickly began coverage. We were new parents, and we also had this new disease that we had never heard of before. It's very rare, as you can imagine, with only 4 or 5 cases a year in Oregon. And then we had to go through the battles of getting insurance coverage. I do work for a company that is self-insured. I work for the News Review. It's a newspaper in Southern Oregon, and we're part of a self-insured privately owned group. And really, having the Oregon state mandate in place played a tremendous role in getting that coverage in place for us. And we are privately insured, self-insured, and we do have coverage. We switched insurance management companies in 2008. 2 months after Owen was born, and once again we had to go to battle to get insurance coverage again. And believe it or not, in 2009 we apparently changed insurance management companies again. So before he was 15 months old, we had gone to battle 3 times to gain and regain insurance coverage for his food. He's now 18 months old. We still haven't gone back to battle again, but we're really hoping that the next time we do have to go to battle over this, that this law will still be in place for him to lean back on. I love my job. I sure hope I don't have to leave that company for any reason, and I don't see them as changing away from being a self-insured company. One thing you might notice, Owen's uncle, or I'm sorry, Owen's great-uncle, my uncle, is Jeff Cruz, who carried this bill into the Senate. It's an important thing for our family. We had no idea that this genetic disorder came from, it had to come from both my side of the family and my wife's side. So it's kind of a shock for everybody to learn about it, and I think that's part of the reason why it was important for him to bring it to the floor.
Good. Well, thank you very much. That's an interesting story about how the mandate makes it easier for you to get coverage under your self-insured plan.
I think it's an essential element to it.
Other comments? Other questions?
Yeah, actually, Mr. Chair, if possible, can you expand on that a little bit about that connection? Did the management company, because it's not News Review that's making the decision per se, somebody's writing a check.
Yeah.
And the company is, News Review in this case. But how is that connection between the state mandate and the insurance company's decision to say, yeah, we're going to cover it?
My best understanding of the situation is that the insurance companies don't have a standard protocol for how they deal with this type of disorder, especially somebody who is managing our self-insured program. So the initial response is just to deny it. They don't hear about it, so they don't know about it, so they deny it. But the mandated coverage that's specified in this Oregon law really gives them guidance on what the right type of coverage is for this disorder. And it's been a battle each time, but the end result has been sufficient coverage for us.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for coming up.
Thank you.
Can we have Cheryl Kelch and Katie Kelch, please?
Chairman Greenlick and representatives, my name is Caitlin Kelch. I'm 16 years old and I'm PKU. I was one of two babies born with PKU in 1992 in the state of Oregon. I'm here to ask you to support the renewal of the medical foods law, also known as Senate Bill 9. Oregon has a law that requires that all newborn babies be tested for PKU. As a result of that law, I was diagnosed and placed on a very strict diet and special formula that saved my life. If I was left undiagnosed and not treated, I would today be mentally retarded, unable to attend school or be employed. It would cost insurance companies a whole lot more to treat my disorder under those circumstances than to cover my medical foods and formulas that make me healthy today. When I was little, most insurance companies covered the special formula that I needed, but one day back in 1995, when my mom changed jobs, her new insurance company refused to cover the formula. That's one reason why we asked you to pass the law originally back in 1997. Today, because the law is expiring, I'm back to testify and ask you for a third time to help us pass this law again. I hope you reach the same conclusion your predecessors in the legislature back in 1997 and 2000 did, and pass Senate Bill 9 unanimously in both the Senate and the House. Have any of you ever had to be on a strict diet? It's not very fun. My strict diet is required for life. So my strict diet requires that I never eat meat, cheese, or dairy of any kind. It is hard to feel like a normal teenager when there's nothing really normal about my diet. I'm grateful that because of the medical foods I've been taking since birth, I'm completely healthy. I attend Blanchett Catholic High School and received a 3.5 GPA on my most recent report card. I work part-time at Papa Murphy's and enjoy volunteering at my church. One thing I really look forward to is going to college. I will be honest, managing this diet is very difficult. I don't know how I could stick to it at all if I didn't have at least a couple of medical food choices to go along with my formula. So, did you know that more than 30 states have passed laws that require insurance companies to cover the cost of medical foods that treat PKU? Please help me and other people like me stay healthy in passing Senate Bill 9. Thank you.
Questions? Talk to us about your food now and how it's covered under insurance.
Well, I don't know the whole insurance part of it because it's kind of more like my parents and everything.
Well, we can ask your mom. Let's ask your mom.
Okay. What would you like to know in terms
of... Well, would you please introduce yourself and say whatever you'd like to say.
Okay. Well, as Katie has already mentioned, she really doesn't have very many choices. Her mainstay is really salad and fruit, and then she has the formula that she has to have every day to be healthy. And really 100% of her nutrition comes from that.
Your name, please. I'm sorry.
Cheryl Kelch.
Thank you.
And so we supplement that with foods that we're able to obtain specifically through OHSU, and that's things like flours to make bread. It's like pasta. It's sauce mixes that don't have the protein content in it. So just a few things that we can add into our diet to supplement the green salad, because face it, you know, 16 years old and that's what you eat every single day. It just, you know, it's really difficult without those foods. So I've been very appreciative of having that coverage.
So you pick the things up at OHSU and they bill your insurance company for it?
Yes.
Great. Are there other questions?
How many, how do you refer to it? How many people in Oregon today have PKU? Do you have any friends that are PKU?
I actually don't. I know there's one other girl in Kaiser that has PKU. She's, I think, in the eighth grade at Whitaker. Not sure if she's here today, but that's the only other person I know of that actually has PKU. And the only other time that I've come in contact with other people with PKU is, like, sometimes they, like, make camps for it at Wild Horse Canyon over in Antelope. And, like, a whole bunch of PKU people just get together and we have, you know, there's really good food that, like, they make for us because it's, like, actual food.
Not like your mom does.
Watch it.
That was me, Mr.
Actual
Chair.
Food. Huh?
They actually bring in a chef that specializes in cooking PKU foods, and they use the products from OHSU to make that a very special weekend where these kids can feel normal.
That's great. Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just
I
just want to thank you, Caitlin, for coming and you know, it's pretty amazing what you've done and I guess obstacles often make us stronger. You appear to be that way, and thank you for having the courage to come and share.
All right, thank you.
Congratulations. It's really great to see you. I'm a psychologist. I remember early in my training seeing these kids back in the 70s in the mental hospitals. Very sad people, and it's remarkable. You're an honor student and obviously an outstanding young lady. Best luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can we have Haki Brenneman and Bedney, Kiko Gomez, and Michelle Hamilton, perhaps? Let's see if we can.
Oh, good.
Chairman Greenlee.
We can take turns, however.
Yes. Oh, whoops. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Chairman Greenlee, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 9. I am Haki Brenneman, the mother of a 25-year-old PKU son. I'm confident that many of you have knowledge of the late Senator Ted Halleck, who served 5 eminently successful terms in the Oregon legislature in the 60s through the 80s. He was the father of our land use planning system. Did you also know that he was the father of a lifelong, untreated PKU victim? Ted discovered that PKU could be treated if detected at birth. He also discovered that Oregon didn't mandate such testing, so his son was permanently and irrevocably retarded. Those discoveries motivated him to run for the legislature, enact a law in his first term, and forever change the lives of all children born with metabolic disorders. He was instrumental in starting Oregon's newborn screening program. Ted's untreated PKU son, Christopher, was placed in Fairview, the Oregon State Hospital, when he was 2 years old. His two sisters never saw him again, and Chris remained institutionalized until his death in 2003. I know this because Ted Halleck was my mom's cousin. Ted's legacy helped enable his indirect descendant, our PKU son, Mark, to reach his full potential. Instead of Chris's tragic life, Mark was tested at birth, treated since birth, and has recently earned his master's in electrical engineering from Stanford University. And that's his picture right here, graduation garb. He is healthy, happy, and actually employed. His treatment.
Good luck, Mom.
Yeah.
Woo!
No more tuition payment. His treatment totally revolved around the use of medical foods. We'll never know what Chris could have done had he been born after newborn screening was mandated and lifelong treatment required. We'll also never know the exact cost to the state of Oregon of institutionalizing Chris for over 50 years. We do know, however, that a treated, educated, an employed PKU victim is a positive economic contributor to the community. Chris's fate was the great tragedy of the Halleck family's life. Please don't let others who are diagnosed with PKU or other genetic metabolic disorders suffer because the simple dietary treatment is unattainable. It would be a terrible toll for them, their families, and ultimately the state. I urge you to continue Ted's legacy of advocating of what is good for the state and pass Senate Bill Number 9. Remove the sunset clause. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, whoever.
Hi, my name is Kikoa Hampton Gomes. I'm 7 and a half, and I have PKU. I know why I'm here today, reading this to you. Hi, my name is Kikoa Hampton Gomes. I'm 7 and a half, and it's because of PKU. I may be 7 and a half, but I know I'll have PKU all my life. And I know without my special food, I may not have a good life. I don't worry about food. Because mom and dad get it for me right now, I do worry if I'll be able to do the stuff I like to talk about doing when I grow up. Having PKU is not fun at all. I can't eat out like other kids. I can't just grab any snack. When I'm hungry, I have to make sure everything I eat doesn't have too much protein. I can only eat fruit and some vegetables with little bits of protein. Mom and Dad don't want me to worry about getting my food.
I say why.
They tell me I'm young.
I have other things to worry about.
Think about like school, sports, and making friends. I do worry because I really don't understand. I make mistakes with my food sometimes, and mom and dad get mad and sad. But if you make sure I get my food, that will help them not worry so much. And then I won't be in trouble, okay? So you can help me. Thank you. Kikoa.
Good job, yay! Anybody have any questions? Thank you very much.
Great testimony.
Thank you. Great testimony. Caitlin, how old were you when you first testified?
Four.
Oh my.
Great. Okay, who's next?
Evan Bedney. Hello, my name is Evan Bedney, and I am 8 years old, and I have PKU. I go to OHSU 2 times a year. I get a shot to see if I am over my fee levels. I talk to Kathleen and get a checkup. I like having PKU because I get to go to PKU camp and my friends don't know about it. And I like having different foods than everyone else. Please say yes to this bill because I like foods and I need foods. Food. Thank you so much. From Evan Bethany.
Thank you, Evan.
Good job.
Good job, guys. Great testimony. We don't usually get such good testimony around here, I have to tell you.
We don't usually applaud.
It's usually somebody that gets paid to testify. Not to say. Okay. I've lost track of where I am. Dee Dee and Justin Vanderveen, is that? Who else? Do I have anybody else? Do I have everybody? Good. You know, that's a tough act to follow.
I know. Well, my name's Melanie Vanderveen, and for the record, you'll see the picture of my daughter on the sheet. She's passing out there. She couldn't be here today. And just to honor her, I would like to just read what she has come up with from her point of view. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Justine Vanderveen. I was born with PKU, or phenylketonuria, a metabolic disorder. I am from Portland, Oregon, and I attend Mount Tabor Middle School. I am 13 years old and in the 8th grade. I have been on the honor roll for 3 years at Mount Tabor. I am a web leader, captain of my dance team. I participate in leadership roles at my church. I love volleyball, singing, and theater. I could be mentally retarded. I am not mentally retarded due to the newborn screening system and the availability of metabolic formulas and medical foods. With the deteriorating state of the economy and major budget reductions, especially in our public school system, how can we be financially responsible for one more mentally retarded child when an obvious solution is in place? I and other children diagnosed with inborn errors of metabolism can be self-sufficient producing leaders in society. My parents are responsible and take very good care of me. I know they have financial hardships to keep me supplied with my formula. They cannot afford to have insurance changes to coverage that has been in place since 1997. I ask you to support Senate Bill number 9. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today on behalf of my daughter.
Thank you very much. You know, I just have a question. My assumption is from seeing these kids at various ages that as long as their food is supplemented, as long as their food is proper, they don't have any other side effects otherwise.
Exactly. You know, and there comes a time when they vary and try things.
But, oh, I'm sure.
It's such a rigid diet, and from such an early age, I think they really get in control of things, and it helps them later in life making judgments and decisions and being able to have a schedule and be disciplined is what I'm looking for. I was going to bring you a can of our formula just to show you the difference. A can of Enfamil, if you can imagine, is $24 maybe on the grocery shelf. I'm not sure how long that lasts, but her can's about the same size, 400 milligrams, I think, or grams of formula. It lasts me 3 days, and it's over $70 a can. So it's a very expensive thing, but she's brilliant, she's beautiful, and she's going to be fine.
Great. Thank you very much. Yes.
Oh, I just a comment, Mr. Chair. I mean, this testimony has been wonderful, and there was a philosopher, and I can't remember his name because I saw it years ago, but his quote was, from disease I have learned much which life could never have taught me in any other way. And this particular disease, is, as you just mentioned, one of the lessons of this disease or one of the attributes is discipline, and that's why you see the amazing academic accomplishments, among other things, that you know, I mean, talk about a silver lining to this horrible disease, frankly, but gosh, the discipline it instills on people.
Exactly.
And the great things.
It's been great.
Oh, yeah.
She has had it set in her mind that in the sixth grade she wanted to go on to St. Mary's Academy, and she thought, oh, my gosh, how am I going to keep my grades up? And she's been able to hold a four-point average for the 3 years, thinking that would help her to get in. So I'm very proud of her.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 9. My intention is to try and hear as many of the Senate bills as we can and then work through work sessions rather quickly. So we're scheduling works public hearings now. Let's move on to Senate Bill 154 and call Sandy Wood from DHS.
Want to tell us about 154, Madam Administrator?
Basically, what this bill does is it repeals the Senior Prescription Drug Assistance Program, which was enacted by the 2001 legislature. The goal of that program was to help low-income seniors get prescriptions if they didn't have other means to do so. But since that time, there are other ways for them. The Medicare D, Part D now helps with prescriptions. And the bottom line is right now, as I understand it, there are only two enrollees in the program. And so it's become somewhat redundant.
Okay. Ms. Wood, go for it.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Wood. I work for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs, and I've been the manager of the Senior Prescription Drug Assistance Program since 2001. Roxy did a great job of just highlighting what this bill's about. The Senior Prescription Drug Program requires us to provide a drug discount card to seniors who have no other insurance and are within 185% of the federal poverty level. This drug discount card allows them to buy their drugs at the Medicaid price. We estimated that there would be about 100,000 seniors who were eligible for this program, and yet in its heyday in 2003, we never had more than 300 clients. Right now, we have none. 2 months ago, I had three, and now we have no clients in the program at all. The reason I want to eliminate the program is because regardless of whether or not we have clients, we have to keep the infrastructure going. We have to keep the computer system so that it can handle it, the eligibility system so that we can enroll clients. We have to keep our staff trained in this program. And it's not worth the work of the infrastructure when we now have programs that are effective for seniors like Medicare Part D and the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. Continuing this program just seems like wasteful government, and it's not how we want to treat our seniors. And I would just appreciate your support of this bill and help us to eliminate a program that's not effective and has no clients. And that concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Are there questions? Do all of these people, are they now eligible for OPDP?
They are. They are, Chair Greenlick. In fact, when we first started this bill, I had three clients in the program. One of them was on the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. We sent applications to the other two, and now all three of them are on the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, and, of course, they've all dropped out of the Senior Prescription Drug Program.
And we could actually go home and brag that we had repealed five laws? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
without
you.
Without opposition, maybe. Even.
without opposition. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 154 and open a public hearing. Do we have anybody else who wants to?
On 154?
On the other bill.
Yes, we definitely do.
Okay. What do we got? Okay. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1005 and call Jack Dempsey, Denise Duran, and Kim Brandt, or whoever comes.
Yeah.
I only see two.
It's Senate Bill 605.
Some more?
We got one out in the hallway who's taking a phone call from
us. Okay, great. Let's start with who we have.
Mr. Chair, I think you missed.
I'm sorry, did I? I said the wrong thing, did I?
Easily yes. Corrected.
I said 1005, and now I see it is really. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1005. Just in case there is one, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 605.
There we are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jack Dempsey. I'm with the Oregon Nurses Association. Bringing you today Senate Bill 605 from the Senate. It's over here on a 30-0 unanimous vote. Senate Bill 605 addresses what I would call an error of omission in language around delegating for nurse practitioners. The intent of the original nurse practitioners dispensing legislation was to include this, and I think most nurse practitioners thought this was part of the law. It was recently that it was clarified from the Board of Nursing through a legal opinion that they sought, where we realized that indeed that this law needed to be changed, where a nurse practitioner has to personally dispense. I think probably the easiest way to kind of explain what we're talking about here is to talk about how prescriptions are filled currently. If you get a prescription, a piece of paper from your physician or your nurse practitioner for a specific prescription, you can fill it a number of ways. You can go to your pharmacy, they can fill it right there. You can use a mail order company a lot of times where they'll just send the prescription directly to your house. Another way that we see this is pharmaceutical companies have what's called a patient assistance program for low-income folks. What this is that after a nurse practitioner or physician has sat down with a patient, educated them on what they need, what the prescription is, how it's taken, they apply to be in this program, and then it goes off to the pharmaceutical company to determine whether they can receive these drugs or not. A number of pharmaceutical companies will then send the prescription directly to the patient's house and avoid the clinic at that point entirely. There are some companies that will send it to the clinic because they want to verify that the right person is receiving the right prescription. At that point, it comes into the clinic. It's a prepackaged drug. It has the name on it. If a physician has written this prescription and that drug comes in, then a trained person in that physician staff can compare the name on the sheet, not fill the, you know, look for the right kind of drug or, you know, add the right amount in. They're just comparing the name with the name of the patient, and that person can do that. In a nurse practitioner's office, a trained person in their office can't do that. They have to personally hand that prescription to the patient. Well, why this is problematic, you'll hear from Denise and my other person I'll grab from the hallway here in a minute. You know, there's a number of rural clinics where the nurse practitioner will travel from clinic to clinic. They'll only be there a couple days a week. If they're not there and a prescription comes in, the patient has to schedule another appointment, use more gas money, travel to a different town, and essentially wait for the practitioner to come in to receive that prescription. So,
Jack, these are dispensing nurse practitioners.
That is correct. These are nurse practitioners that have dispensing rights already, correct.
Right. So how does it work in their office is the question.
How does it work in their office?
So this isn't something comes in the mail for a patient with their name on it.
That actually is one of the main reasons for this before you today is that program through pharmaceutical companies that give these drugs free of charge to low-income patients.
So you wouldn't have any problem then restricting this to only things that have come into the mail, to the clinic by mail with a patient's name on it?
I'm going to say no on that. I'll let these two kind of dive into that a little more and have them explain to you how this works in the practice.
Yeah, my question relates to the same thing I asked Senator Monis Anderson. It's that are we talking about packages that already have the patient's name on it?
Yes.
Or are we talking, well, let's make sure.
And even if they're the ones in the office, they're still ones that have already been put together that have their name on it. So that is a non-judgmental function. Your question as far as what non-judgmental means and how that's defined, it's not, it's in The language in this bill is the same language from the medical statute. Medical board rule does not define that. The Board of Nursing has told me they intend to sit down with the pharmacy board and clarify that in their rule so that it's crystal clear what we're talking about here.
I want to put crystal clear on the record what it is, the legislative intent is.
Yeah.
But let's hear from
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlich and Healthcare Committee. My name is Denise Drin. I am a nurse, family nurse practitioner in Medford and Grants Pass, and I provide primary care. I also represent the Oregon Nurses Association, the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon, and the ONA Cabinet on Health Policy. I've been a registered nurse for 33 years and have worked for 11 years as a nurse practitioner in Oregon. I'm sorry, I lose my train of thought if I stop. I have a keen interest in delivering health care to patients who are particularly confounded by health care access, and I have devoted quite a number of years to this particular population here in Oregon. In Eastern Oregon, I worked for a few decades as a registered nurse in tandem with a nurse practitioner who was the sole provider of rural outreach clinics in Gilliam, Grant, Sherman, Wasco counties, a number of places like that where she would rotate only to one clinic each week. In providing this care, I'm sorry, I'm losing my train of thought again.
We're really intimidating.
Yes.
These guys are not.
Mr. Chair, I know Denise.
Oh. You know
her. Yeah, she's from my district and
yes.
In fact, know her to professional self.
That's your fault.
And it is my fault. I will not look.
No, I'm always shy with public speaking. These counties, as well as the one that I'm currently working in Josephine, are federally designated health care shortage areas, which Oregon has quite a few of. It's and quite a number of have a severe shortage of health care providers in a number of the communities across the state. The law currently requires nurse practitioners to personally hand medications to patients. That is, if they are not dispensed by a pharmacist. Now, I want to emphasize that all people who prescribe, be they podiatrists, DOs, MDs, NPs, physician assistants, all must rely on the same responsible behavior and public safety criteria when we prescribe. And that would mean explaining side effects, interactions, all of the information that pertains to the safety of taking any medication. So this does not speak to that. Those aspects that ensure public safety are already being provided at the time that the prescription is prescribed. The issue at hand is that of all of the prescribers, only advanced practice nurses must personally hand prescriptions to patients. No other professional must do this. And this is a means of significant hardship for the patient, and it is very disruptive of clinical practice, and this actually leads to a reduced healthcare access. I'd like to give an example from my own professional practice, if I may. I'll take that as a yes.
You're on. Yeah. We haven't stopped you yet. Keep rolling.
It's very common that medical providers conduct quite a few well women's examinations through a given day. A big part of that is family planning. after the medical provider and the woman determine the safety, efficacy, and the desirability of the family planning method, she is left to get dressed. The provider goes to the sample closet, picks up whatever is determined, say birth control pills. Typically these are packaged. No, they do not have this particular person's name on them. But as a prescriber, it would make little difference whether I gave the person a paper prescription or whether I went to the sample cabinet to actually choose the samples for this person. In the case of a physician, they would put this in a bag, give it to the medical assistant, and they would go attend the needs of another patient in the wings. In the case of the nurse practitioner, we must wait until this patient is fully clothed, back on track, and is present so that we can personally hand the patient their medications. Because of this law, I recently had something, and this has happened quite a number of times, but more recently, just very recent, a situation arose, and this is common, in that while I was waiting for the patient in the restroom to come back so that I could give her medications, a mother ran in with a child with a deep laceration of her chin that needed to be sewn up, and I was the only provider there that day, which necessitated that I had to make the decision whether I was going to comply with the law and wait for the patient so that I could hand them their medications, or whether I could attend to this child.
Can I ask a question about that example?
Yes, please.
At that point, did it have the patient's name on the drug?
May I answer that in my own words, the way that I see that? Theoretically,
certainly don't
it
use
does
his words.
Because if I am the prescriber, if I am the prescriber, and I am writing that name on the paper, and then I'm also getting the samples from the sample cabinet, those do not have anyone's name on them.
No.
But they are matched.
Let me explain my question.
Yes.
Let me explain my concern. I envision in a rural practice, I envision a cabinet, perhaps even a room, that has a variety of drugs in it. It has amoxicillin up here. It may be by antibiotic, or it may be by alphabet, or it's, you know, there's all these drugs. Now, I have no problem whatsoever if what we're talking about is the nurse practitioner goes and picks out the bottle of amoxicillin, puts it in a bag with the patient's name or a label with the patient's name, and gives it to a receptionist and says, give this to Mrs. Jones when she comes in.
Yes, that's what we're talking about.
That I have no problem with. I have a big problem with the possibility of the nurse practitioner talking to the patient, recording the prescription, and then calling a receptionist and saying, give Mrs. Jones the amoxicillin, at which the receptionist then has to go to the cabinet and pick out amoxicillin out of birth control and whatever else. I have no problem whatsoever with the first, but I have a significant problem with the second. So I just want to make sure, particularly since there aren't any rules that define non-judgmental, I want to find out a way to make sure the understanding is this is intended to be the nurse. I mean, I think it's dumb for the nurse practitioner to have to give a package with a patient's name on it to that patient. But I worry about the other opportunity. And if it turns out physicians are doing it the other way, then I want to tighten up their law because I have a problem with that model. So that's all I'm trying to ask you to explain, which is intended here.
Chair Green, like, that's a very good point there. I have never, ever seen a physician allow, or a DO, a physician assistant or a nurse practitioner, ask any clinic staff to randomly choose medication based on a recommendation without them going to prepare it themselves, put the name on it for the patient, because that is a legal mandate that I've never seen not followed.
Great. That's all the concern I have.
And that's a very real concern. I see your point.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, can I explain how I saw it and how we practice it? This is from observation.
Surely you weren't the one that got the pick.
No. Well, it was usually our medical assistant, say, my wife would say, go to the clinic and I need this. And the assistant would go to the clinic or to the cabinet. We had several cabinets, pull out the stuff, the samples, because that's all we ever sampled, hand it back to my wife, and they would go here. I mean, it was, so they were.
So she got to look at it before she handed it to the patient?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the point. Just as a pharmacist would get to look at it if it was a written prescription before it got to the patient. I don't mind, again, in the pharmacy will look at it and say, okay, this is Mrs. Jones, and give it to the assistant to give to the...
And in this case, there's no repackaging of the drugs. Is that correct? This is all prepackaged medication.
Oh, maybe.
That's correct.
If you're...
Some dispensing offices do it differently, I suspect.
But they are licensed to be dispensers, which are different than a medical office that just gets samples, which are different.
No, we've licensed them to be dispensers. And in the 2000, that's the bill we're amending here. We have given nurse practitioners the ability to dispense medications in their office, not just samples.
Okay.
The issue is around prepackaged drugs. It's around samples. And in dispensing cases where a pharmacist or the practitioner would put it together and label it and put their name, the patient's name, on the package. Your first example is exactly right. That's exactly what we're talking about here.
I'd like some language that tightens that up, if that's the case. Representative Denbrough?
Well, just, my assumption is that the inclusion of physicians, you know, having this this way of dispensing, that's been in the statute for a long time, mm-hmm. I assume. Have we heard any problems with that? Because I think, I see this as just a sort of technical fix that nurse practitioners were not in the original statute because they didn't have prescribing authority. They subsequently gained prescribing authority. Now this statute has to be changed to allow that to happen.
To allow what to happen?
To allow the nurse practitioner to do the same practice as the physician.
Well, have you looked at that statute to see if that's the case? I would like to look at that.
I believe so. Yeah, that's all. It takes
a physician statute.
It takes the existing statute and just adds nurse practitioner to it, I think. Is that not right, Jack?
Yeah, the language in bullet 4, section, sub 4, is taken from the medical statute.
It's not the same statute, though.
It's not the same statute, but it's the exact same language.
I'm sorry, what are you talking about? Which piece, please?
On the second page, number 4, the part that we're amending into the bill is taken directly from the medical statute. Are you asking where this is in the medical statute?
The Legislative Council didn't recreate the wheel. They just took that and replaced it with...
No, there's a reason we want this to mirror the medical statute. I mean,
and
we could
except
do this with
that
a
non-judgmental words
correct.
Came. And the medical board's never defined what non-judgmental is?
That's correct.
And I know the pharmacy board hasn't either defined what...
The Board of Nursing will do this. I know they intended to do that. They've already talked to the Board of Pharmacy, as have we. They intend to sit down and define it exactly how we've been discussing this. And I guarantee you they will not define working with the board... And their new direction, they will not define that beyond what we're talking about today.
Perhaps Ms. Mercer will come and talk to us about it. We haven't given you a chance to testify. We're getting late. We have another group yet to testify.
Sorry, I had a little fire to put out at my own office.
I bet.
My name is Kim Brandt. I'm a nurse practitioner at Willamette Family Medical Center in Salem. I live in Dallas and practice in Salem. Our clinic is a kind of all-purpose clinic. We're a not-for-profit my actual testimony thing is back there. So.
They have it in front of them.
Okay, great. So I'm talking off the cuff because I don't have it in front of me right now. We provide services for all kinds of patients, and from basically cradle to grave, from newborns all the way to elderly. Thank you. We do have a large number of patients who have no insurance at all. We have a large number of patients. Probably our largest is public insurance, such as Oregon Health Plan and Medicare. And we have a good... batch of folks that have regular employer provided insurance as well. So we have a really nice variety of patients in our clinic. We are increasingly having patients that don't have insurance, and this is where this comes in. This is where people who don't live in rural areas do have to dispense, because when we ask our patients who can't afford to buy their prescriptions to apply to the drug companies to get the medications free, the drug companies send them to our office to dispense to the patient. And this is not just handing out samples. This is handing out medication that we have to label with the patient's name, that we have to make sure there is adequate information for the patient, and that, generally speaking, the patient has been talked to already about in our office. Many cases, we have patients who have been on the same medication from the same drug company labeled by us for years, and we still have to go out and hand the patient the prescription. In the written statement that you'll see, I had an incident with a patient a few weeks back, probably a little over a month ago. She was told her medication was ready. She came to the clinic, and I was not free. I was seeing other patients. These things arise where you're really pretty much stuck seeing, the people that have already made their appointments to be there, and you want to be on time for them. Her medications were mental health specific. She had some issues with having to wait that long. She walked out without the medication and never came back. She was very angry. I understood that. You know, we've made some adjustments to make that not be so difficult, even if I do have to hand in the patient. And as long as I have to do that, I'm going to do that because I want to abide by the letter of the law. But my point is that these are indeed already labeled medications. The patient has received education on them. They're familiar with the medications. They have the patient's name on them. They're generally enclosed in a package in addition to the bottles, and the package has the patient's name on it. And this lady could have been out of my office in 5 minutes if my assistant had been able to hand it to her, and she couldn't do that. It had to be me. And some of our patients, as you might notice on my testimony, they do actually budget gasoline to be able to come in and pick up meds. And they can't always come in, you know, just whenever it suits us. We kind of have to adjust to them. So that's what we're dealing with is the, in my view, I certainly support having to continue to have nurse practitioners do everything that has to do with prescribing that requires professional judgment. But I feel that when it reaches the point where the medication is labeled, the patient is educated, they know what's going on, to have my very conscientious assistant go out and hand them the medication and ask them if they have any questions for me seems to me to be adequate to their needs and much more convenient for the patients. I've probably spent more time here today than I would be spending over the next 2 months handing the patient the prescriptions, and I don't mind that. It isn't so much that it's inconvenient for us as that it's seriously inconvenient for many of our patients, and I agree that it can limit access if patients can't wait. Thank you.
Are there other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 605 and open a public hearing on House Bill 327A. And we have a few folks. Oh, we're doing okay in time. Let's see. Phil Donovan, Dr. Rick Arinell?
Arinelli.
Oh, not bad. I was. Oh, there's the eye. Right. Dr. Rita Bettenberg. Enough to get started. And then we'll have Dr. Kevin Wilson, Ann Walsh, and David. I'm not sure.
Walls.
Oh, Walls. W-A-L-L-S. Okay.
Penmanship class to follow.
Looks like Euculus, I thought. Yes.
Before I forget, may I mention that we have a letter to put into the record from Dave Riggs, who is from the Oregon Primary Care Association, and he's in favor of the bill.
Great.
Chair, members of the committee.
Your show. You got us for half an hour.
Good afternoon. Thank you. We'll be to the point. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 327. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Existing naturopathic prescribing authority dates back to 1953, and since 1989, naturopathic physicians have been prescribing medications utilizing a naturopathic formulary, a formulary that then State Senator Bill Kennemer helped support and put into law. So it goes back a little ways there, sir. Along with the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners, our association has been contemplating a change in the prescribing authority to allow naturopathic physicians to prescribe medications that are synthetically derived. The current statute states that a naturopathic formulary can only approve medications that are naturally derived. As you heard earlier from State Senator Lori Montes Anderson, we were a part of the process to develop this scope of practice review because we've known that these issues have been vexing for the legislature. But we think that this process has us on the right path. It basically tees up a template of questions to make sure that a change in scope is related and based on the education and training of a profession. It's based on the public safety to the general public and not necessarily professional turf wars. So in front of you is a 40-plus page document that responds to those questions. And what we've set up today is four individuals who helped write this document summarize what's in here for you in less than 30 minutes. But I do want to take a quick moment to provide an explanation of, you'll see that this is A. Engrossed. And as you referenced earlier, Mr. Chair, there, you know, when the psychologist legislation was considered, you noted that it had been a bit of a one-sided discussion. And the Naturopathic Physicians Association went out on the road for 4 months and talked to other healthcare stakeholders about this proposed change. And you can see all of those meetings are documented beginning on page 22, who was met with, what were the issues that were discussed. But at the end of the day, we showed up for our first Senate bill hearing and found a letter of opposition from some of the stakeholders that we'd been meeting with. And it was like, oh, wait a second. We've been talking, but it wasn't until you had a public hearing. And Senator Montes Anderson said, okay, folks, Thursday, be there at high noon. Actually, the case was it was happy hour. But be there. And at that time, we showed up for the meeting, and only the Oregon Medical Association and the Osteopathic Physicians Association showed up to talk about what their concerns were with the bill. And frankly, we had a pretty good discussion. I felt like we were able to help dispel some misunderstandings about the education and training of naturopathic physicians. And you can find that discussion summarized on page 25. But at the end of the day, the Naturopathic Physicians Association offered a compromise to address some of the primary concerns that were raised by the Oregon Medical Association. And so that is what you get today is Senate Bill 327A. And the compromise, if I could quickly summarize, basically states that we will maintain the existing formulary, but the naturopathic formulary would now be allowed to consider and approve medications that are, in fact, synthetically derived. And we believe that such a change will help naturopathic physicians provide better and more health care opportunities for Oregonians. And so with that, I would like to share that we have Dr. Rick Marnelli, who's on the Naturopathic Formulary Council, to provide some of the historical context. Dr. Rita Bettenberg, who's a dean at the National College of Natural Medicine based in Portland. Kat Ann Walsh from the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners to talk about the regulatory environment that we operate within. And finally, Dr. Kevin Wilson, who's with the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, legislative chair. And they were the primary authors of this document. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could, I'd turn it over to Dr. Marnelli.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Marinelli. I'm a primary care physician. I'm a naturopathic physician. I've been in practice for 27 years. I serve currently as the chair of the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Examiners, and I'm also a member of the Naturopathic Physicians Formulary Council. On behest of the Formulary Council, approximately 3 years ago, the council, who's made up of two pharmacists, community-based pharmacists, a pharmacologist, a pharmacognosist, which is a fairly rare breed these days.
You don't have to have them anymore. Right?
No, we have the very last one, who's a very distinguished Dr. Block, who I think taught every pharmacist in the state. His list of publications is longer than this table. He's a fine gentleman. He's a great addition to our council. In addition, we have a medical doctor and two naturopathic physicians. The council recognized from submissions that naturopathic physicians were submitting that one of the primary lapses in our current formulary, which is broad in its scope, if you've looked at the actual list, it includes every major category of pharmacotherapeutics and many controlled substances, as well as a host of other medications that I should say are used responsibly and conscientiously by naturopathic physicians. But a consistent request was a very interesting, basic, simple drug called hydrochlorothiazide. Hydrochlorothiazide is a synthetic diuretic, which is very cheap, generally effective, and not on our formulary, and not allowed to be on our formulary because it has the distinction of being purely synthetic. While naturopathic physicians appreciate the potency and the synergy, perhaps, of naturally occurring substances, there's a recognition, especially with our science background, that synthetically derived drugs may be more efficacious. In fact, one of the largest trials ever done, called the ALHAP, the antihypertensive and lipid-lowering treatment trial to prevent heart attack, which actually looks at hypertension, treatment of hypertension to prevent heart attack, stroke, and heart failure, showed that of the three primary medications that are used, hydrochlorothiazide, a calcium channel blocker, which is on our formulary, as well as an angiotensin converting enzyme drug is also on our formulary, that, guess what, the cheapest, most effective drug at preventing all those was hydrochlorothiazide. Naturopathic physicians are smart prescribers. You have a submission from one of our formulary council members, Kathy Raker, community pharmacist, stating that explicitly in her experience in working with naturopathic physicians. I can't tell you how frustrating this has been to naturopathic physicians to not be able to prescribe a drug that has been shown to be the most effective at prevention of this, really the number one cause of mortality and morbidity and a significant drain on our health care system. This has also affected healthcare throughout our state in the sense that naturopathic physicians have been limited from being primary care practitioners in rural healthcare clinics, in underserved areas, in community healthcare clinics, and other primary care practices because of this lack of ability to prescribe some very basic medications. We can prescribe methadone. That's on our formulary. That's a drug that requires sophisticated knowledge. Hydrochlorothiazide, not so much. It's simple in its action, and it's something that would save a lot of money and a lot of suffering, mortality, and morbidity in our state. I think also it bears stating that naturopathic physicians really do not like to use medications if they're not necessary. In fact, we prefer to do prevention and primary care, and I think that our record speaks for itself in terms of safe service to our state. Especially in that situation, and our evidence from the Board of Examiners shows that very rarely are naturopathic physicians in trouble for negligent prescribing or for inappropriate prescribing. We've had very few complaints along that line. In addition, I think that if this bill is passed, then what you have is a situation where the Naturopathic Physicians Formulary Council is still overseeing any drugs for inclusion in the naturopathic formulary, which I think is an important thing to state. This is a body that presently meets twice a year and is very conscientious, very smart, very dedicated to allowing naturopathic physicians to have the tools that they need to effectively treat their patients. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick and the committee, my name is Dr. Rita Bettenberg. I'm the dean of the naturopathic medicine program at the National College of Natural Medicine in Portland, where I graduated in 1989. I've been in practice since then. I did a primary care rotation or residency rotation And I became a faculty member at that time, and it became more and more of my job. And currently I have a very limited private practice in Portland, but most of my job is educational and administrative at the college. I also serve and have served for the last 8 years on the Council for Naturopathic Medical Education, which is the Federal Department of Education accrediting board for naturopathic colleges in North America. I want to give you a quick overview of the program at NCNM because I think this is something that sometimes legislators don't know about. The ND program at NCNM is the oldest in the country. It requires 4,620 hours of education, which includes 1,548 hours of direct patient care education. This is comparable to the educational requirements for other types of medical schools. The numbers of hours are comparable. It is a four-year in-residence program. Admissions requirements for NCNM require a bachelor's degree from an accredited college, just like every other medical school in this country, and also a list of science and social science prerequisites for entry. The first 2 years of the education is in the classroom is biomedical sciences, again, equivalent to other medical schools, and then in the second year, diagnostic education. Includes anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, histology, embryology, microbiology, immunology, pathology, the ologies, that are used in, again, most medical education. The Human Physical Science Foundation is followed by extensive diagnostic training, diagnostic procedures that include physical examination, diagnostic imaging with x-rays and so forth, laboratory diagnosis, etc. And success in mastering this material is measured by the students taking a biomedical science national board exam, which measures their proficiency in the basic biomedical sciences. They can take that test after their second year. Again, that's very similar to that's the same as what's done at OHSU for the medical program. The second 2 years of the program is more focused on translating this basic science and diagnostic knowledge into application with patients. The clinical science area includes specific courses in different organ systems. They learn gynecology, they learn gastroenterology, those sorts of things, within a framework for a family care physician. Students concurrently take courses teaching disease management and prevention. These are done in terms of these organ systems courses, as I mentioned. And then they learn throughout their education the therapeutic modalities. So you diagnose and you determine what's going on, then you have to determine how to treat that. And in a naturopathic school, some of the treatment modalities include botanical medicine, herbal medicines, nutrition, physical medicine, homeopathy, lifestyle counseling, etc. Minor surgery and pharmacology are included also in our training, and our students are taught how to utilize those in patient care. Diagnostic and treatment skills are developed and assessed during the students' clinical rotations, which take place in their third and fourth year with medical doctors, naturopathic physicians, chiropractors at times, and other specialists doing the teaching in the clinical program. Faculty in the program are required by Oregon law to have a terminal degree in the discipline that they teach. This is an unusual requirement by ODA, but we comply with that. The curriculum is assessed and updated regularly by a curriculum committee, as is required by our federal accreditation. The course content and the integration of didactic material into clinical training is addressed in this committee. And changes are made in response to information gathered from alumni services, licensing law changes in various jurisdictions, and, of course, advances in medicine. Interventions by naturopathic physicians, as I mentioned, include the utilization of pharmaceuticals when appropriate. Naturopathic medical students have been required by law to learn about all classes of pharmaceutical agents since I've been in Oregon. That's 25 years. And from the beginning of the time that naturopaths were allowed to actually prescribe drugs. So they already learned about these drugs, that some of which they can prescribe and some of which they couldn't, for the simple reason that their patients come in on the drugs and they have to know what the effects of those drugs are. So our students are still required to learn about drugs and medications that they can't prescribe as well as the ones that they can. The current program includes 72 didactic hours of classroom education, which includes the principles of pharmacodynamics, side effects of drugs, and therapeutic uses of the legend of prescription drugs. This compares very favorably with the didactic education for other medical professionals with legend drug prescribing rights. And, of course, additional emphasis is placed in the clinic on the drugs that they can prescribe because that's what they're allowed to do by law. Most of the coursework is taught by MDs and PharmDs. So there are people who are
wrapping up, please.
Oh, certainly. Students are exposed routinely in their clinical training to the appropriate selection, prescription, and management of the legend drug use. Their clinical rotations provide the ability to see patients and manage them when they're on the drugs. Students learn to prescribe under the supervision of doctors who are skilled in the utilization of those drugs. And, of course, a lot of times the experience they have depends on the patient, types of patients that they're seeing in the clinics that they're working in. Some clinics, that's all they do is prescribe drugs. In other clinics, it's a more naturopathic care. I guess I would just like to summarize that the programs are accredited by the Department of Education, the Federal Department of Education, as a programmatic, by programmatic accreditors, and also they're accredited by regional accreditors for the institutions. So they're required to have two sources of accreditation by the federal government. Licensing examinations, I mentioned the biomedical science exam. They also have a clinical exam that they have to take in order to be licensed in any state.
Let me, if I could, Mr. Chair, just summarize by saying there's a lot of questions that you find in this template that was put forward, and that was what Dr. Bettenberg was endeavoring to summarize for you all. The benefit of that has been, though, as we've gone out to meet with the different healthcare stakeholders, when they've asked tough questions, we've always had the answers. So with that, we'll close and we'll let the other two speak. Thank you.
Thank you. In fact, I'd like David Wall first, please.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask a question first.
Sure.
Dr. Bettenberg, in looking at the bill on page 3, I guess you have a close formulary and a process for adding these drugs, these new ones to it. And you talked about the background of naturopaths is that they're competent to prescribe in all four categories of medication. I guess the question I have is that these will be new, these synthetic drugs will be new to them. What is the process to make sure that naturopaths are up to speed with medications that none of you have prescribed before? And how do we have assurance that they are safely and appropriately prescribed?
In the past, when drugs have been added to the formulary, our licensing board requires continuing education of the doctors in Oregon. So that's mostly what's happened, is that we've been required to take additional continuing education in those areas. And as far as it being added to the students' coursework, it's added to the students' coursework. You bet.
The new students, but I'm just concerned about the existing practitioners.
Right.
That's right. Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenemer. The situation is that naturopathic physicians are the only health profession in Oregon that has an ongoing annual requirement for pharmacists, for pharmacology.
Right. Continuing ed requirement? I'm sorry.
That's right, a continuing education requirement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David Wall, please.
And may I read two
please
letters into the record, Mr. Chair? Both of them dated May 6th, both of them in support of the bill. One is from Jennifer Pratt, Director of Policy, Oregon Primary Care Association, and the other is from Kathy Rakers, who is a pharmacist.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Walls with the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon. I apologize for my handwriting. I am not a physician, but I do have their handwriting. So. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on our concerns on Senate Bill 327A. I've submitted for the record written testimony from Mike Jascodio. He's the president of the Osteopathic Association. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today to speak on this bill, but I'd like to say a few words on his behalf. Osteopathic physicians, or DOs, have a proud history of serving in primary care fields. About 60% of osteopathic physicians go into a primary care specialty, most of those going into family practice specialties. We agree that there is a need for primary care providers in Oregon, a critical need for that. The osteopathic profession is addressing this. There's a new medical school beginning in Lebanon, Oregon in 2011 that will be training 100 DOs a year in the program, up to 100 DOs per year. And the osteopathic profession has worked very closely with Samaritan Health Services in Corvallis in development of a residency program that's starting this year with a family medicine, internal medicine, and psychiatry program. It's important to note that this was very important before we put this school together because physicians, where they train in their residency typically shows where they're going to end up practicing, and we wanted to have that residency program set up first so the graduating physicians have a residency program to begin in. We're concerned about attempts to address the healthcare crisis by expanding prescription privileges but not requiring any additional training programs. I appreciate the tremendous amount of work that's gone into this scope of practice bill. It's been a very great learning experience, and I've learned more about the naturopathic profession, and I do appreciate all that work that went into that. We do have some concerns, and we also appreciate the amendments to the bill that make it an inclusionary formulary, but we still cannot support this bill because it does not allow any additional training requirements. Naturopathic medicine serves an important role in our healthcare system. It's an alternative form of medicine for patients and citizens in Oregon who do not want conventional treatment. They're looking for natural treatment. They can go to a natural physician. We're afraid that this bill will take the natural out of naturopathic medicine and cause consumer confusion about the type of providers they can have. In the testimony, I've included an updated table in the testimony from the naturopaths. In Table 8, they included information on the education of NDs and FNPs is the updated version. I didn't have the original one. I don't think it's an accurate statement to say the training of the naturopath is equal to that of other practitioners in Oregon that have full prescribing rights. If you look at my updated information, I've highlighted areas which I've changed. The information, if you're looking on the columns, the first column from the National College of Natural Medicine, that's the naturopathic program, and that was what was originally included in their testimony. The second column is from the Family Nurse Practitioner Program, and I've updated it with information I received from Kim Jones, the Director of Family Nurse Practitioner Program at OHSU. And the final column is the Western University of Oregon Health Science, or Western University of Health Sciences College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific. That's the new DO training program that's coming into Oregon. The key that I wanted to point out is in the clinical practices, the clinical training. We aren't questioning the classroom, the didactic training that naturopaths complete, but the training from the DO and MD programs is, for the specific DO program, is 88 weeks of clinical training, which is typically an average of 60 hours per week, which is 5,280 hours of clinical training. That does not include residency programs, which are required by MDs and DOs alike. Minimum three-year residency program to become board certified would make the total hours in the residency 8,640. From the nurse practitioner program, I understand it's not 610 hours, but 1,044 hours of clinical training. That includes the 660 from the master's requirement, and then as a registered nurse, there's 380 hours of clinical training required, plus any clinical training they had in their bachelor's degree. The final point I want to point out is on the last part of the table, and that's the supervised clinical practice under faculty with synthetic prescribing privileges. The family nurse practitioner clinical faculty have experience in prescribing synthetic substances. So family nurse practitioners clinical training is with DOs, MDs, family nurse practitioners who are prescribing synthetic substances. The DO MD training, clinical training, is under board certified DOs or MDs who have experience in prescribing synthetic substances. The training under the naturopathic program, clinical training, is with naturopathic physicians who do not prescribe synthetic substances. So we believe that is a very appropriate training model for the current formulary. Typically, naturopathic physicians are not prescribing as many substances, but it's again, with their limited formulary, it's the appropriate training for that program. If we're to expand into synthetics and allow naturopaths to prescribe synthetic substances, we think there should be additional training training, especially on the clinical side, to warrant that increase in privileges. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. So naturopaths are currently able to prescribe drugs like Vicodin and codeine. I'm not hearing in your testimony the specific concerns that you have with extending. What should we fear if we extend this ability to the synthetic drugs?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Canyon, thank you for that question. MDs and DOs who have almost 14,000 hours of clinical training are challenged with complex drug interactions and prescribing, and they have 14,000 hours of training. I know DOs, one of the I've went and talked to some of the DOs in the area, and when they come up with a patient who wants a botanical medicine or a natural medicine that they don't have the experiences, they just can't have that much training to get all the botanicals, all the synthetics, everything under the sun, they'll actually send their patients out to a naturopath who specializes in that and sees it every day. I just don't see in 1,548 hours that there can be enough clinical training experience for a huge expansion in breadth and essentially an open formulary of drugs. I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I'd like to know, in reality, how many DOs are referring to naturopaths? That one.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Maurer, I do not know a single DO who prescribes botanicals or natural.
That wasn't the question. How many do they refer back to?
If a patient requests a botanical or natural medicine, they will refer that to a naturopath.
No,
they
are not. I'm asking for actually how many actually have done that. I mean, you're not a provider, and I've seen it in the real world. Doctors don't refer to nurses usually. Kind of, you refer up this chain, not sideways.
Again, Chair Green, Representative Maurer, I don't know that exact number. I actually would love to do an informal survey on it, but in my discussions with DOs, a fair amount have done it. I would say half the people I've talked to will do that if the patient requests a botanical medicine.
Okay. We're going to, thank you very much. We're going to run out of time, but we're going to, when we bring this back up for a work session again, I really would like to have some time for discussions like what is the difference between a naturally occurring drug. I mean, I look at diphenhydramine, and I remember from my training as a pharmacist, it came right out of the Park Davis laboratory. It's not be interesting to see how some of these, what really differentiates a drug that comes from natural sources. But we'll get this back and have a chance to talk about it. And I'm committed on most normal days to get my colleagues here out on time. It's now 5 o'clock, so I will close the public hearing on